الترب ما هي خفيفة بيحملوها اتنين وصغيرة طير الحمام بيقطعها بيومين من كتر ما هي صغيرة
Good morning and welcome to One Land, Many Voices, broadcasting on 90.7 FM every fourth Friday of each month and hosted by Will Seaman and Hala Goris. Guest hosting for Will and Hala today are Ned Rosh and Zaha Hassan. Good morning, Ned.
Good morning, Zaha. I'm looking forward to this show.
Well, now our first... Oh, I'm sorry, Ned. Would you like to introduce what today's program's about?
Sure. Today's show looks at different ways of challenging Israel's violation of Palestinian human rights and its denial of Palestinian self-determination. Our guest for the first half hour is Sarah Kirshner, who will be talking about the work of the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network in challenging Zionism and Zionist institutions that support Israel's dispossession of the Palestinian people. In the second half of the program, we'll speak with Paul LaRudy, an activist who was on one of the ships that last month attempted to break the Israeli naval blockade of the Gaza Strip.
Now to our first guest, Sarah Kirshner, who is joining us from the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit, Michigan. Excuse me. Ms. Kirshner is an American Jew based in San Francisco and co-founder of the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network. IJAN was established in 2008 and is made up of a network of Jewish people from 10 countries who are committed to struggles for human emancipation, of which the liberation of the Palestinian people and land is an indispensable part. IJAN is committed to dismantling Israel's apartheid system, the return of Palestinian refugees, and ending the Israeli colonization of historic Palestine. It challenges the false claim that Israel and Zionism speak for all Jewish people and lends a strategic voice that challenges the allegations of anti-Semitism lobbied at anyone who criticizes Israel. Sarah brings to this work her history in developing transformative justice approaches to addressing intimate and community violence. After her father tested positive for HIV, Sarah began her organizing and social justice work in the harm reduction and HIV movements. Sarah is part of building a growing network of social justice activists interested in bringing together radical personal and political transformation. Welcome to One Land, Many Voices, Sarah.
Thank you, Zaha.
Sarah, for many people, the idea of a Jewish organization being anti-Zionist might seem oxymoronic because of how well Israel and its supporters have been in conflating the idea of Jewishness and Zionism. How is it that you came to anti-Zionist activism yourself, and has there always been Jews, or have there always been Jews against the idea of establishing a Jewish state?
I came to working on Palestinian liberation and to anti-Zionism through my other work on challenging racism in the United States and being involved in South African anti-apartheid struggles. And so for me, there came a point where, as a Jewish person working and involved in political work in the United States, I felt like I had a responsibility to not allow Israel, as you said, Zaha, and Zionism to claim that it spoke in my name. Me and many of the others involved in the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network see ourselves in continuity with a long history of Jewish participation in liberation struggles, from working class struggles in Eastern Europe and Russia to the civil rights movement here, to participation in the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa, to working class struggles in Iraq. And that included throughout history Jewish opposition to the idea of Zionism, and certainly particularly in Europe, Zionism was supported by a minority of Jews. And it was over time, and of course with the Nazi genocide, that then Zionists were able to organize and to convince many Jews that they could only find safety in a Jewish state. But there has been a consistent thread of opposition to Zionism since its beginnings. And in fact, the initial World Zionist Congress was going to meet in Munich, and the Jews in Munich opposed Zionism so strongly that they had to move it to Basel, and thus the first meeting was there.
Interesting. And is the movement growing today? Is it very large, or is the activism around anti-Zionism in the Jewish community relatively small?
We're growing. We just had a national assembly in Detroit prior to the U.S. Social Forum. We had 200 activists from across the country, all of whom are unequivocally anti-Zionist and committed to anti-racist struggles in this country, as well as in relationship to Palestine. And that represents really only a fifth of the broader Jewish anti-Zionist network who's involved in one way or another with our work. And then, you know, IJAN is one organized international group of anti-Zionist Jews, and we have chapters in Canada, in France, in the Netherlands, in the UK, in Argentina, growing chapters in Vienna. We have chapters in Spain. And we are one of many who are organizing on principles of anti-Zionism. So, you know, our numbers may not be huge, but where our numbers become larger is that through our opposition, we hope to create more space and give support to the many, and in fact, the vast majority of people in the world who oppose Zionism. And we find that those are the numbers that are growing, and our numbers are also growing, but that together there are more and more people questioning the very premise of the State of Israel in addition to its policies and practices, particularly after 62 years of hearing justification for it on the grounds of the oppression of the Jewish people. And as we step out to say, this is not a justification, and this, and how we see the world taking responsibility for that history is in making sure that other people don't experience that, and certainly other people don't experience it in our name. So our hope is that our numbers grow not just of Jews, but of other people, as more and more Jews are willing to confront that myth.
Sarah, share with us a little bit about your own personal journey. Were you always an anti-Zionist?
I grew up, I went to Hebrew school and temple 3 or 4 days a week. My family was of the Reform temple, but I was raised very much by Jewish traditions, ritual culture, and religion. And so I was in an atmosphere where the assumption was a support for Israel, but my family, myself, was not very Zionist. They didn't talk a lot about Israel. They didn't actively fund or support Israel. There were parts of my family that did, but my immediate family did not. And so I grew up in a household where I was taught by my own father that never again meant never again for anyone. And he really ingrained that into us growing up, though, you know, politically, he didn't have a position on Israel. That was the environment I grew up in. So I wouldn't say I ever grew up as a strong Zionist. I grew up understanding that somehow Israel was connected to me, and I was generally expected to support it. And then as I got more involved in other political work, and read Edward Said's book, The Question of Palestine, I remember being in college and just and writing an essay saying, well, I mean, of course the Palestinians need a homeland. Like I literally didn't understand the question. And I remember my TA, who was also Jewish, voicing surprise at my response, and I didn't even understand the response. So I would say I was generally ignorant. And then as I got more involved in anti-racist work, anti-war work, anti-apartheid work, it became clear that this was in line with that work, and then I developed my own thinking and educated myself so that I could really understand what my position was, and then through that, I don't feel like I had a choice. Like, I felt like who I am, what I was taught in my family, and the way I was politically involved, you know, the logical conclusion was anti-Zionism. It would seem entirely contradictory for it to be anything other than that.
Sarah, do you think it's possible to be a Zionist and support Palestinian human rights, as those who support a two-state solution seem to believe? Might there be a new understanding of Zionism that can coexist with Palestinian self-determination?
I mean, I don't, because of how I understand Zionism as a political movement that started in Eastern Europe by white Eastern European Jews, whose leadership was largely working, I mean, largely middle class, though who mobilized around it was broader than that. And that was a movement to form a Jewish homeland in another people's land, and Uganda was looked at as a colonial project, and then Palestine was settled on as a colonial project. When you read the ideology and the dehumanization and the very planned colonization, that is what the Zionist political movement was about, and has maintained, I don't see how it's possible to maintain a Zionist state. And when I say Zionist, I mean a state based on the belief that Jews have a right to land and a homeland within the broader Middle East that they are not indigenous to, in the form of a Jewish homeland, and that they're willing to maintain at any cost. Now, there are people like Moshe Makover, who is firmly and unequivocally anti-Zionist and the founder of the Matzpen movement, the Matzpen organization inside of Israel, which was a Jewish and Palestinian Israeli anti-Zionist organization founded in 1959. And they organized inside of Israel and then later in the UK as people left Israel. You know, he argues for the possibility of a Hebrew nation, like that would be defined by democracy and language and nation. And that's not agreed to by a lot of anti-Zionists, but he's positing that, but it's based on an actual redistribution of power, genuine democracy, where you might have, or other people have thought about, confederations. So I think, no, it's not possible to have a Zionist state and support a Jewish state that is of the nature of privileging Jews in the way Israel does, based on the idea of Jewish nationalism, where Jews living anywhere can come to this particular part of the world at the exclusion of the indigenous people, Palestinians or others. So in that way, no. Do I think there are people who are committed to a Jewish state who it genuinely disturbs that there are massacres of Palestinians and that Palestinians lived under, you know, militarized containment in the West Bank and in Gaza as well as in East Jerusalem? Yes, I think there are people who are Zionist and who don't really have a historical view of what has been required and what Zionists knew. Jabotinsky said, if you think Jabotinsky is one of the founding fathers of Israel and Zionism, he said when he wrote The Iron Wall, you cannot displace and maintain a settler colony, and people weren't shy about that. Zionists called it for what it was. They knew what they were doing. If you think you can maintain a settler colonial state on an indigenous people's land and not get resistance from the native population, then look at the history of America. No native population willingly gives up their life, land, and way of life without resistance. And to the credit of the Palestinian struggle, they've been able to maintain that opposition for 100-plus years since before the founding of the State of Israel. But Israel has followed that policy. You have to have a highly militarized state because it is a settler colonial state, and it does that on an ongoing basis, not just in 67. There's an ongoing process of building on Palestinian land, removal of indigenous people. It's happening in the Negev now. And so that is the ideology, the policies, and the practices of Zionism and a Zionist state. So it's a contradiction completely to maintain a state of that nature and think that it's compatible with human rights. Now, there are people who are in lots of good questions about what happens to the Jews who are now living there, including the Jews from the region who were displaced from their own countries with the founding of Israel. And that's a good discussion and one that should be and we hope will be taken on by the many Palestinians, first and foremost, who are committed to justice and who do operate on principles of democracy and justice. And who I've never heard a call for anything but the creation of a society that is just. And it has to be discussed with other people in the region, other movements in the region who are also seeking societies based on justice and human rights. So that was a long answer, but I don't think those things are compatible, which doesn't mean that I don't think there are people who are committed to Israel who are genuinely distraught by the level of violence that maintaining Israel has required.
So if the goal is to deconstruct and delegitimize Zionism, what alternative vision or visions are you proposing?
Well, what we look at is not a solution. We are largely a network that we of Jews not living inside of Israel, though we work with particularly Jews of Arab descent who are living inside of Israel and who are in complete joint struggle with the Palestinian people and movement against Zionism. But as an international network, particularly, and a lot of where we do our organizing is in Europe, in the U.S. and Canada because of the relationship and support that those governments give to Israel. We really feel like it's not for us to put out solutions. Again, that has to come from within the Palestinian struggle, within the movement, from Jews who are committed to justice living in Israel to all the movements in the region. It feels like an extension of the way the U.S. and Europe has control and dominated and dictated and tried to control what the Middle East and other parts of the world look like that they're not of. And so we don't prescribe solutions. What we're interested in is the idea of the principles and what kind of a process will support the creation of a truly democratic society, just like we organize for in the places where we live, that is based on cultural, economic, and social rights. We align with those organizing in Palestine most closely who also adhere to those principles. When we say we believe in the, you know, we think that has to include the right of return. And when we take a stance on no deportation and ethnic cleansing, that's of course true for the Palestinians, Bedouins, or others who the State of Israel is deporting and ethnically cleansing. But we're certainly not calling we certainly wouldn't support the reverse if there's a non-Jewish state. In other words, when we stand on principles of no deportation, we think that's true for everyone. So that would also be true for Jews living there who want to be part of that society and who are willing to participate in it and are not destructive of it. We also think it's very, very important to talk about and look at processes of reparations. How do you reinvest and what resources are owed back to Palestinian people and society so that it can have self-determination and self-governance? And then what's a process once you have a redistribution of power and resources of building relationships between people who have been taught to not live together, who have very intentionally been taught not to live together. And that has to be first based on an actual redistribution of power. Otherwise, you can't ask Palestinians to participate in that, but there has to be a process of actually people rebuilding and society rebuilding its relationships when there's been so much oppression, and that has to be determined by those who have been oppressed, which is the Palestinians in this case. But that rebuilding of society is part of the vision we hold. Now, how it happens, the details of that aren't for us to work out, but who we work most closely with are first and foremost Palestinians, but others who are really aligned with those kinds of principles and visions. But we feel like none of that is possible without a decolonization of Palestine and an actual departure from Zionism.
Sarah, could you tell us some of IJAN's specific plans to challenge Zionism? I know there's an international campaign to challenge the Jewish National Fund. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So with the Palestinian Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions Campaign National Committee and the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign and Habitat International Coalition, IJAN was part of putting out a call for a coordinated international campaign against the Jewish National Fund. For us, this was a very important target because when you spoke in the beginning, Zaha, about the dispossession of the Palestinian people and Palestinian land, the Jewish National Fund has been around since 1903. It was founded by Herzl, who's considered the founding father of Zionism. And it was founded to manage confiscated land and or land purchased under exploitative conditions. And then that land was kept in trust per its memorandum of understanding for Jews living anywhere in the world, and explicitly stated that land held by the JNF was not to be leased, rented, sold, or tended to by Palestinians. So it's an organization that was created to control and maintain land and property gained by a variety of mechanisms. And it is based on the idea of Jewish nationalism, which means that Jews living anywhere can have have national rights inside of Israel. And again, that's at the complete exclusion and with the intentional attempt to then eliminate those rights for the indigenous people who are Palestinians. The Jewish National Fund sits on the Israeli Lands Administration, which means it operates as a nonprofit in over 50 states, but in fact it serves the functions of the State of Israel in the management of land inside of Israel, and it can represent that land administration in international institutions and bodies. So there are several reasons we're challenging this. One is that as young people, many of us were enlisted to contribute to the Jewish National Fund. We had trees planted in our name, and those trees were planted over Palestinian villages to disappear them. We gave money in these little, what we called tzedakah boxes, charity boxes, and all of that went to the Jewish National Fund. We feel as Jewish people deceived on the true nature of the projects that the Jewish National Fund was involved in. And so as Jewish people, we have a complaint around that deception. And of course, we're part of the many other people who disagree on no uncertain terms with land confiscation, with ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from land and property, and then the managing of that property by an organization like the Jewish National Fund, and with the idea that an organization that is designed to support and advance a part of any formal government for any reason, that's not the nature of a nonprofit, but B, particularly a state that is based on apartheid and discrimination and institutionalized racism, is something we feel like the public needs to know, that their states are condoning this as a charity act. So that's the campaign. It will include education and exposure of the Jewish National Fund and the many Zionist organizations it's connected to. It will include legal action. It will include international and diplomacy action. And it'll include popular action. So that's a campaign. And many, many people have been working on campaigns against the Jewish National Fund. So what we're doing is not new, but what we're trying to do, and there are many, many organizations now part of this coalition, and we're encouraging anyone who wants to be part of it, that we can bring this to an international scale and really challenge its ability to operate with impunity across 50 countries. So that's one key piece. Other parts of our work, all of our chapters are involved in boycott, divest, and sanctions campaigns and work, and other forms of solidarity work done by non-Jewish Palestine solidarity activists. But one of the most important pieces of our work is to challenge and really to be able to express our own complaint and our own outrage at Zionism for the ways in which it, A, betrayed Jewish people at the time it was as a movement. The Zionist movement courted the greatest anti-Semites of its time who shared an interest in the displacement and removal of Jews from Europe and Russia into a Jewish homeland. A couple of examples are Plev from Russia, who was one of the organizers of the most violent pogroms in Russia at the time, and Herzl and Weizmann, the first president of Israel and then the founding father Herzl of Israel, went to him and said, if you fund a Jewish state in Palestine, I will get rid of your resistance to Tsarist Russia. And that shared interest and why Plev and Tsarist Russia wanted to get rid of its Jews is because Jews were very actively involved in challenging the very oppressive and exploitative Tsarist system. So you see the Zionists go there. Jabotinsky, who I mentioned earlier, was trained by Mussolini, a renowned anti-Semite who participated in the Nazi project. And then, of course, there's a long and well-documented history of the Zionist collaboration with the Nazis, both in breaking the Jewish labor boycott of the Nazis and thus undermining one of the most powerful tools against the Nazis, but also in actually working with the Nazis on helping to transfer Jews into work in concentration camps so that a few selective Zionists could get their money out and themselves and their families out of Europe and into Palestine to bring resources and people into Palestine to establish Israel. So we have our own historic complaint against Zionism, but we also object to the way that Zionism tries to pull us away from the rest of humanity. We see the Jewish history of persecution, which is largely European Jews, because Jews from the Middle East, Africa, Asia, are largely, it didn't go without discrimination or contestation, but largely lived without persecution and discrimination for thousands of years. So we're talking about European Jews who are the Jews who initially colonized Palestine. Sorry, I lost my train of thought. But
Sarah, thank you so much for taking time out of your activities. I know you were doing a workshop at the U.S. Social Forum on the campaign against the Jewish National Fund, among other workshops that were going on there related to Palestine and anti-Zionist work. So I want to thank you very much for being here and for answering our questions, and good luck in all that you do. If there's, is there a website folks can go to get more information about IJAN that we could share today?
Yes, there's two. One is www.ijsn.net. And the other is we have a lot of the speeches and talks given at this U.S. Assembly of Jews Confronting Racism in Israeli Apartheid that just happened. And that's www.JewsConfrontApartheid.org. So thank you so much, Saha and Will. I appreciate your questions and the discussion.
Take care.
Bye.
بحب البحر لما يزوم وعشق صرخته في الريح واحس في موجه شوق مكتوم لناس حرة وحياة.
Welcome back to One Land, Many Voices, broadcasting on KBOO 90.7 FM. It's now a distinct pleasure to introduce our next guest. Dr. Paul LaRudy spent 14 years in Arab countries as a U.S. government advisor, Fulbright lecturer, teacher, and student. He has visited Palestine, Israel many times since 1965 and is active with the International Solidarity Movement, a nonviolent resistance group. He's a co-founder of the Free Palestine Movement and the Free Gaza Movement, whose boats broke a 41-year-old Israeli naval blockade of Gaza in August of 2008. He was on the recent flotilla of humanitarian aid ships that was attacked by the Israeli Navy for attempting to break the siege by bringing humanitarian supplies to the people of Gaza. Israel's commando raid left 9 civilians dead and sparked international outrage. The raid occurred in the early morning hours of May 31st on 6 vessels filled with humanitarian aid in international waters bound for Gaza, where 1.5 million Palestinian residents are in their third year of the Israeli-imposed blockade. Paul, welcome to One Land, Many Voices.
Good to be with you, Ned.
Tell us a little bit about the Free Gaza Movement and why you decided to go on the flotilla of ships carrying humanitarian aid to Gaza. What did you hope to achieve?
Well, the objective was simple. It was to break the siege of Gaza and bring humanitarian aid there and to open the passage for to make it possible for the people in Gaza to live like people everywhere in the world, able to trade and travel and live normal lives.
And how did you get interested in the first place in working for justice in Palestine, Israel?
That goes all the way back to 1965, when I first visited the region. My father was working there at the time, and I was studying in Europe. And like so many who have visited the area, I discovered that what was actually happening there was very different from the picture that we get in this country and in many other places as well. And I was angry. I was upset that I felt cheated and lied to, and I felt that there was a great injustice going on, and that I had to do something about it.
Can you take us back, Paul, to that day in May when you were in your boat, the Svendoni, in the middle of the international waters on your way to Gaza? And tell us what happened that day.
It was, of course, at 4 o'clock in the morning. It was dark, and I had gone downstairs to get something. I've forgotten what. And when I came back, I discovered that on the two stairways going up to the upper deck, commandos were coming from two of their small boats. I joined them in going up the stairs because it was the only way for me to get up there, and they didn't stand in my way because to do so would have blocked their passage, so they let me go up with them. And so when I got up there, I joined in the nonviolent defense of the wheelhouse where we locked arms and stood our ground. And they smashed the windows. They tasered us multiple times and used stun grenades and tear gas. And they beat us with batons and rifle butts. So eventually, of course, they prevailed and tied us with nylon ties, handcuffs in effect, and seated us around the upper deck. I slipped away and hid out in a place right behind the wheelhouse in order to hear the traffic that was going on. They didn't spot me until it became light, but they left me alone, and then I came out, joined the rest of them, began some resistance to what they wanted. They would, if they asked me to sit down, I would stand up. If they asked me to stand up, I would sit down. But I saw an opportunity there throw a monkey wrench into it. And in front of, because there were all these witnesses there, I decided to jump into the sea and essentially force the Israelis either to abandon me or to have to fish me out again. And that did indeed slow down the vessel. They had to stop for a while because everybody on board would have seen that they just abandoned me. And they brought in another vessel to pick me up. So, and that vessel took more than an hour to get me out because I did evade them for a while.
And when you were taken to, I believe, Ashdod, is that correct?
Yes.
Tell us what happened and how long it took you to get home.
Well, again, in Ashdod, I refused to cooperate. After all, they had abducted us on the high seas. Everything they did was illegal. I wasn't about to cooperate with them. So as soon as I got on the dock, I just collapsed, let the body go limp, and made them carry me wherever they wanted. They did so rather brutally. They tried to force me to walk by inflicting pain on me, twisting my limbs, and sometimes hitting me. And eventually they put me on a stretcher, but none of this was very good for a good media image for them. So they quickly put me in an ambulance, took me off to a hospital. I refused to diagnosis or to respond to the doctors, and so they eventually took me back. And by that time, there was less media, but they ended up at that session beating me. About 10 of them picked me up and carried me to the other side of the room and kicked me in the head, slammed my head against the concrete floor, and a few other things. Because I had demanded replacement of my trousers, which had a gaping hole in a very strategic place, and I had been waiting about 2 hours for them to do something about getting me another decent pair of pants. After they had beaten me up, I shouted quite loudly that they still needed to do that, and so they quickly put me in a police van and took me and one other person to a totally separate prison from the other passengers of the Sindoni.
So Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, Paul, wrote in a letter to his constituents, and I quote, "In May 2010, the pro-Hamas Turkish Humanitarian Relief Foundation organized a six-ship flotilla to try to break the blockade. Israel urged the flotilla to unload its cargo and offered to deliver their supplies to Gaza. When the flotilla refused, Israeli naval commandos boarded the ships and took control of five without incident. On the sixth ship, armed individuals attacked the commandos, and the confrontation resulted in the death of eight Turks and a Turkish American." What would you say, Paul, about Senator Wyden's description of what happened?
Well, there are so many lies in it that I don't know where to begin. But obviously there was resistance on all of the vessels, not just on the Turkish vessel. The fact that it didn't result in deaths on those vessels doesn't mean that there wasn't resistance. On the Greek ship, for example, they set up razor wire to prevent the commandos from coming on board. What else they did, I don't know. I wasn't there. But they, as far as I know, every single vessel put up resistance, as they should. The way this is spun, that Israeli soldiers were attacked, if Israeli soldiers hadn't come and attacked the vessels, there wouldn't have been any need for any kind of defense. But they were the attackers in international waters of vessels that had no armaments on them, were not smuggling anything dangerous to Gaza. There was no security threat at all to Israel in all of this. There's just no excuse, and the lack of perspective is stunning.
You know, Paul, that 87 out of the 100 senators sent a letter to President Obama defending Israel's actions against those who joined the Freedom Flotilla in its effort to break the blockade of Gaza. Of course, our senator Ron Wyden was among the signers, but also two of your senators, Senators Feinstein and Boxer, signed on. Have you made any contact with those senators' offices, and have you told your story to your representatives?
I have worked with my representative in the House, George Miller, who, in fact, I have to say, he is better than most. He intervened on my behalf personally, but also he was the leader of the group that attempted to get Judge Goldstone to come here and to have hearings in Congress about the criticism of the Goldstone report, because you know that Congress ended up denouncing the Goldstone report. But George Miller was one of those who voted against that. So we haven't tried so much with the senators. It's just very difficult in a state the size of California to get access to senators. But we have spoken with Barbara Lee and George Miller and others. And here in the Bay Area, of course, we're kind of special in that regard, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
It seems that the Free Gaza movement never could have anticipated that this flotilla would make waves internationally. The Israeli raid provoked denunciations from around the globe, turned a spotlight on the immorality of Israel's blockade, tore apart Israel's key regional alliance with Turkey, and further embarrassed a weak U.S. administration that is desperately trying to breathe life into a dying Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Because of the Israeli attack and the killing of civilians, people around the world are now more aware of the siege of Gaza than ever before. Where does the Free Gaza movement go from here, Paul?
Well, I can't speak for the Free Gaza movement. I'm no longer directly associated with them, but the Free Palestine movement has essentially the same mission. And the gratifying thing about all this is that the mission of both of these groups has been widened and is shared now by many groups around the world. This is exactly what we wanted, and there are offers of more flotillas, more ships, We know that Lebanon, Iran, and other groups are planning for flotillas, and this is very gratifying. We our objective from the beginning was to get as much participation as possible. What the I think what has happened is that individuals, ordinary citizens around the world, have realized that they can make a difference, and that's exactly what's happening. And this flotilla has made is really, I think, a turning point in this. It's unfortunate that it took 9 deaths to make this happen, but we are growing into a popular grassroots civilian movement that I think cannot be stopped.
15 months ago, Paul, Tristan Anderson, another San Francisco Bay Area native and Palestinian human rights activist, was shot in the head at close range by a high-velocity Israeli tear gas canister while he was in the Palestinian village of Ne'alin taking photos of a protest there around the construction of the separation wall. Without ever having visited the scene of the shooting, the Israeli military report indicated that the Israeli soldiers were cleared of any wrongdoing. Yesterday, as a result of an appeal brought by Tristan's family, a district court in Israel has found gross negligence on the part of the Israeli military in its investigation of Tristan's shooting and has ordered a new investigation. Knowing this and how Israel has conducted itself and so many other of its internal investigations, do you have any faith at all in Israel's investigation of itself and what happened on the Mavi Marmara?
I would have to say I don't. If anything comes out of this exposing what really happened and what the general policies are and who gave the orders and this sort of thing, I would be shocked. But you know, I suppose it's not impossible. Let's not hold our breath. Tristan is one of thousands of participants in the international solidarity movement. They're all part of ordinary people making things happen. Tristan is now back in California. I'm looking forward to seeing him, hopefully in the next few weeks or months, whenever he's ready. Of course, but he's an inspiration to all of us, and we continue to send volunteers to do the work that Tristan and Rachel Corey and so many others have done in Palestine. Let me just add that we have a few projects in the works. One is to send an aircraft to Gaza, either later this year or early next year. George Galloway and others have, Code Pink, have broken the siege by land. We've broken it by sea. It's now time to do it by air. And we also have plans for, with our Palestinian partners, for Palestinians to fly into Tel Aviv Airport to assert their right to return to their homes. We're hoping to put together a major concert for Palestine with artists, major artists taking part, and to internationalize all of this. There are many, many projects in the works.
Wow. Israel recently announced an easing of the siege, allowing in more goods to Gaza than before. Paul, as you see it, is this a victory?
I do not have high expectations for this. Israel delivered more than 100 of the scooters and wheelchairs that I saw being loaded onto a cargo ship in the port of Piraeus. They were delivered to Gaza, but without any batteries. This was particularly cruel. This, I think, is indicative of what we can expect from Israel. they will not allow what they call dual-use items, which potentially could be anything. It could be construction materials. They say that construction materials could be used to build bunkers for fighters or something like that. They will deny an awful lot of things under that, and who knows how long it'll last. They can easily take away privileges as soon as they want to. And one thing that is not mentioned is that they are imposing a complete blockade of exports of things leaving Gaza. Now, what's the security concern there to send things out of Gaza? That is, its only purpose is to strangle the economy of Gaza and leave the people destitute. So there's been essentially no discussion of that. So I really don't see that as much of a change in policy.
Paul, I wanted to ask you about the reports of missing passengers. There have been some reports that among the 700 or so passengers that were on the six ships, that there are some that have not been accounted for. Have you heard anything about what's happened to these passengers and what's their status?
Well, I don't know for sure, and I'm not really in a position to, but I have heard that all the organizations that were involved in the flotilla have been asked to account for their members, and all of them have. So that at least as far as these organizations are concerned, there's nobody missing. If there are some missing, there is some speculation that they were spies or something like this. I suppose that's possible. But otherwise, I can't really explain the discrepancy.
And you've talked about your involvement with the International Solidarity Movement and Tristan. Would you say a little bit more about how ISM works?
ISM trains and sends volunteers, ordinary people who are willing to participate in the Palestinian nonviolent resistance movement. When they get there, they're assigned to villages or to locations where the people want foreign participation in their activities. The participation of people from around the world often makes a difference, because what happens to them gets back to their home communities in one way or another. And it helps to bring world attention to what's happening there. If the Palestinians resist entirely on their own without international participation, there are chances that fewer people will be watching, and that the violence that is used against them will be greater.
I'd like to go back to a key point of a disagreement that the two sides have regarding the flotilla. Israel has claimed that there were terrorists aboard the ships. Who was really on these ships, and what was your experience with the people that you met seeking to break the siege?
As far as Israel is concerned, I think they consider anyone who's not a Zionist to be a terrorist. So we're all terrorists. You and I and Zaha and everybody is a terrorist. They see terrorists everywhere. They found them in the IHH because the IHH had some affiliation with the Muslim Brotherhood, which itself is not a resistance organization, but the Muslim Brotherhood had affiliations with some groups that eventually evolved into Hamas. I mean, the degrees of separation are amazing, but if you want to go far enough, you can find some kind of connection somewhere. This is absurd. The IHH is a humanitarian aid organization. It's a Muslim humanitarian aid organization, and we have to stop being allergic to Muslims And they were delivering humanitarian aid. What do we have to do if these so-called terrorists arrived in Gaza? What would they do? They're not taking arms. Israel found no arms on board, and they didn't expect to. If there were any arms, there are an awful lot of people who would never have taken part, and it's totally destructive of the entire effort to take those arms. The ships were inspected before going. We shouldn't pander to these ridiculous arguments by Israel.
You know, last weekend, picketers in Oakland, California, prevented the unloading of Israeli products from a ship, and dock workers refused to cross the picket lines. Similar actions have occurred in South Africa, Norway, and just yesterday in Sweden. Do you see the boycott, divestment, and sanction campaign against Israel as being energized by the Freedom Flotilla publicity?
Absolutely. We're all feeding off each other, and people are feeling empowered. Even in the United States, where it's really hard to get things going, you have last year's Hampshire College divestment success, and you have the efforts, for example, at the passage at UC Berkeley of the divestment resolution, even though it was vetoed by the president of the student council there. All of these things are building, and people realize that we can do something about it, and they want to do something about it. I think it's reaching a point where it can't be stopped, and we are in effect at a point where the anti-apartheid movement was, let's say, somewhere around 1987 or 88. Where it was clear that it was going to mobilize the entire world. We didn't know what the outcome was going to be at that time, and some of us were surprised that apartheid collapsed so fast. But it's a good lesson that we can change things, and I think that's exactly what's happening now.
That does it for this month's One Land, Many Voices. On behalf of Zaha and myself, we'd like to thank our guests, Sarah Kirshner and Paul Arudi, as well as our technical engineer, Todd. And a quick announcement, and that is that at 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. Thank you very much for joining us. See you next month.